How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, Thy God reigneth.
WCCO and Twin City Federal present Minnesota Milestones. Faith of Our Fathers. The Story of Religion. Minnesota, a land of churches. This is the story of the faith our fathers brought with them when the land was young. It is a story of Catholic, Protestant, and Jew, of those who believe what they feel in their own hearts and minds. A story of church spires that rose into the sky from humble chapel beginnings. A story of trial and hardship. A story of strife and conflict. And harmony, too. WCCO presents this fourth program in a series of 12 hour-long special broadcasts in honor of Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. This year-long series we call Minnesota Milestones. I'm E.W. Zebarth.
I am Cedric Adams.
And I am Bob DeHaven.
Together, we will tell you the story of these men and women of great faith who built not only churches, but schools, who brought to a raw frontier wilderness a faith they had known in other lands, who battled against peril and wickedness and greed. Here, another thrilling chapter in Minnesota's history, another Minnesota milestone, the faith of our fathers.
And get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land I will show thee.
Unto a land I will show thee. And that land was the wilderness. The first to arrive in the land of the Sioux and the Chippewa, the first to challenge the domain of Manitou the Mighty, God of the Red Man, were the French explorers and fur traders. Radisson and Groseilliers, they were. They came from Montreal through Lake Michigan and across Wisconsin's rivers by canoe, then up the mighty Mississippi, the broad, shining father of waters. Long ago it was, 1648. They made camp on Prairie Island near what is now the city of Hastings. And though they were primarily explorers, these men from Catholic France did build a chapel and taught their faith to the Indians. Father Louis Hennepin, a Franciscan priest, arrived by the same route late in the 1600s and was captured by the Sioux. He had been robbed of his chalice and vestments and could not say Mass. But it is recorded that Father Hennepin baptized a dying Indian child, the first baptism in Minnesota. It was 50 years later that two more Catholic missionaries came to Minnesota, erected a chapel at a trading post on the west shore of Lake Pepin. And there on the 4th of November, 1727, the Mass was said by one of the two missionaries, we do not know by which one, Father Guinness or Father de Goner, the first Christian service in Minnesota.
Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus Pater, e Filius, e Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
These same words of benediction were spoken 5 years later at the first Mass inside the stockade of Fort St. Charles. The French explorer, Verendrye, had established the fort on an island in Lake of the Woods, and the Jesuit priest, Father Jean Aulneau, had come out from Montreal to build a chapel at the fort. In the summer of 1736, Father Aulneau was the first clergyman in Minnesota to give his life for his faith. He and his companions were ambushed by Indians and massacred. It was in the early 1800s that men of God from all faiths answered the call. They came up the Mississippi, across the Great Lakes, the priests of the Catholic faith, and the Presbyterians and the Methodists and Baptists and German Lutherans, Episcopalians and Swiss Protestants. A Slovenian priest, the Reverend Francis Xavier Piers, dedicated a cedar bark and deerskin chapel at Grand Portage and opened a mission school, the first in the new land. And Father Piers wrote,
"Since I wish to train those poor savages to become not only good Christians, but also industrious laborers and good men, I also led them from temporal misery to befitting prosperity. At the time of my arrival, those inhabitants of the forest were in such misery and suffered from famine to such an extent that I was moved to tears of compassion."
A log chapel built a little later at Grand Portage stands today. It is the oldest existing church structure in Minnesota. But it was at Fort Snelling, the center of civilization in the Minnesota Territory, that Protestant missionaries first took up their work. Two Methodist missionaries arrived one June day back there in the early 1800s. They were the Reverend Alfred Brunson and the Reverend David King. An officer of the fort greeted them warmly.
"Ah, gentlemen, I am delighted to see you, delighted. I would be pleased if you would hold a service for some of the men of the fort."
"Why, certainly, Major, either Brother Brunson or myself. You let us know when you hold services."
"That's the difficulty, Mr. King. We don't hold services too regularly, only when missionaries arrive. I would be pleased if you would have service this Sunday."
"Fine, Major, I shall be ready."
And the Reverend Mr. King was ready. A makeshift pulpit was constructed in one of the rooms of the fort. The soldiers, the Protestant soldiers, filed into the room and took their places. And David King preached eloquently. His text, Ephesians 5:14.
"Awake, thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. Yes, here in this territory of Minnesota, Christ shall give thee light. Christ will give you the light that will save your soul from eternal damnation. Save your soul from Satan and all his legions. I beg of you to listen to his call. Awake, thou that sleepest."
And that's the truth, the recorded fact. The Reverend David King pounded so hard that he shattered the makeshift pulpit. But the officers at the fort and the soldiers were delighted. They had not heard preaching like that in many a day. That next year, Alfred Brunson toured the Chippewa country to find a suitable place for a mission. In his written account of that trip, he says he covered 1,550 miles, most of it in canoes.
"I had been so long exposed to the sun, and my face was so marred with mosquito bites, that when I hove in sight of my own house, and but a short distance from the door, my own wife, with whom I had lived for 27 years, did not know me."
And the Reverend Mr. Brunson became famous later in Minnesota's early days as a circuit-riding preacher. Other early-day missionaries and preachers also achieved fame. Reverend William Thurston Boutwell, who worked with the Chippewa at Leech Lake and Pokegama. Edmund F. Ely, working at Sandy Lake and Fond du Lac. The Reverend James Lloyd Breck, Episcopal missionary, among the pillager Chippewa at Leech Lake.
"Woe to the rebellious children, said the Lord, that take counsel but not of me, and that cover with a covering but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin."
And the missionaries labored in this raw land, attempting to bring forth a harvest of souls. But all too often their efforts were unrewarded. Their writings are filled with despair, and little wonder. The obstacles they faced were tremendous. William Watts Falwell has written,
"The first attack of the missionary upon such heathen as the Minnesota savages was bound to be disappointing. The new religion had to supplant an old one, ardently believed and interwoven with the traditions of the ages. The Indian was intensely, even devoutly, religious. The medicine man exercised an influence over the tribe, surpassing that of any body of ecclesiastics over civilized believers. The evil deities, whom they could placate with charms and offerings, would, according to their teachings, destroy the nation should it abandon the ancient religion for a new one. The incantations of the medicine man assured success in the hunt and on the warpath. The feasts and dances led by them celebrated victory over the enemy and welcomed the returning braves laden with the fruits of the chase or flaunting the bloody scalps of the foe."
It was not only the Indians that troubled them. The missionaries had to contend with their own people. They had to contend with trappers and traders and boatmen, tough, hard-bitten, sometimes evil men. The plain truth is that the white man's example did not often commend his religion. Many traders were crooked, greedy, and licentious. Soldiers were coarse, rough, and even brutal. One missionary recounts this scene.
Ah, good morning, great chief. May the blessings of our Savior Jesus Christ be upon you this day.
White father talks much of Jesus. Other white men, not so good. They talk of Jesus, too. Is it same Jesus they call to when they are drunk or angry?
No, chief. It is not the same Jesus. Some white men are good. Some white men are bad. Some Indians are good. Some Indians are bad.
White father, you have spoken strong words against fire water and impurity. White father, my friend, these are words you should carry to your white brothers who bring us the fire water, who do evil to us. They are sinners.
To the missionaries of whatever faith, it seemed there was far too much evil, too little good, never enough kindliness, and such a little bit of Christian love. There was Father Lucien Gaultier, the pioneer priest of Mendota. Back in the 1830s, he was called from his home in France by Bishop Loris of Dubuque. Father Gaultier was sent to Fort Snelling to minister to the Catholic soldiers and settlers who were flocking to that wilderness outpost. He said Mass in the homes of Catholics, traveling up and down the river from Mendota, which was then known as St. Peter. Squatters were settling on the river flats around the fort and at Point LeClaire and Dayton's Bluff downstream. A rough log chapel, built by a dozen settlers, was dedicated under the patronage of St. Paul on November 1st, 1841, and the community that grew up around it became known as St. Paul. Father Gaultier tried to organize a temperance movement to fight drunkenness among the settlers at the river landing around his little church. And here is how he reported conditions to Bishop Loris.
Since a few days before Christmas, there has been almost a continuous Saturnalian merrymaking or drinking bouts, on the St. Paul side especially. The fact that I do not have these men, whose stomach is their god, more under my jurisdiction, retards me.
And then those moments of spiritual uplift, of light crashing through the darkness in the missionary's heart. That same year, when Christmas was over, Father Gaultier looked back with joy on the midnight Mass, the devout and faithful receiving Holy Communion. And with renewed hope, he wrote the bishop,
"The feast was glorious and has made us forget many of the difficulties, setbacks, and miseries which we have endured."
And there was a Presbyterian missionary, Gideon Pond, perhaps the most successful of the missionaries among the Sioux. He met similar feelings of despair when he wrote of the Indians' plight.
"They bade fare soon to die, all together in one drunken jumble. They must be drunk. They could hardly live if they were not drunk. They would give guns, blankets, pork, lard, flour, corn, coffee, sugar, horses, furs, traps, anything for whiskey. They drank it, and they broke each other's ribs and heads. They knifed each other. They killed one another with guns, knives, hatchets, clubs, firebrands. They fell into the water and the fire and were drowned or burned to death."
And yet it was not a missionary, but Indian agent Taliaferro at Joseph Renville Station in southwest Minnesota's prairie land who reported,
"Now this band of Indians raised nothing, but depended upon the chase alone for subsistence, and with no other means of improving their condition until the American Board of Missions located Reverend T.S. Williamson and S.R. Riggs at the post. With the arrival of the missionaries, a visible change for the better has been effected in the habits and general conduct of the tribes around the mission station."
It was the Pond brothers, Samuel and Gideon, who performed one of the greatest missionary services for the Sioux Indians. They succeeded in translating a portion of the Bible for the Indians and making a phonetic transcription of the Sioux language. It was laborious work. Samuel Pond tells how he learned his first Sioux words.
"I asked a white man who seemed to know something of the Indian language how to ask the name of a thing in Sioux. And then I approached a Dakota who was standing by a pile of iron and I asked its name. Hey, Dako Huho?" The Indian looked surprised. But he smiled and said,
Maza, Maza.
And then he dipped a little water in his hand from the river.
Mini, Mini.
Then he took up a handful of sand from the river bank.
Wayaka, Wayaka.
Hey, Daku Huo.
Pate.
Hey, Daku Huo.
Hehaka.
Pate was buffalo. Hehaka meant deer in the Sioux language. We had a key now to the Dakota names of visible objects, and it did not rust in our hands for want of use. We began to study the language there on the banks of the Mississippi without an interpreter. And there we made the first collection of words for the future dictionary and the translation of the gospel.
And gradually, hope and faith did replace the despair, the hopelessness those early missionaries felt. Oh, list the work of these early priests and pastors high among the many milestones in the history of Minnesota. For they brought the first civilization to our land. Missionaries not only brought the Christian gospel, their most important work, but they were the first school teachers, the first singing masters, the first counselors, the first reporters and historians. The men who came after them accomplished great deeds, as you will hear. But it was the early men of God who laid the foundations for the Minnesota of the years yet to come. We'll continue our story of religion in Minnesota soon, but let's take just a moment to put a good sound foundation under your castles in the air if you've been dreaming about a new home lately. You know, a happy home depends a lot on sound financing, the kind that fits your budget without pinching. And if you'd like to build or buy here in the Twin Cities area, I'm sure you like the home loan plans available at Twin City Federal. They have a variety of plans for you to choose from, and you'll get expert help from one of their counselors. You'll get quick service, too. Service Twin City Federal is rightly proud of. If you have a home picked out, in most cases, you'll have your answer in less than 48 hours. And if you're still just in the planning stage, stop in to talk it over anyway. Chances are you'll get a lot of valuable tips. Tips that will help you make wise decisions in the biggest single purchase of your life. Twin City Federal is so conveniently located, 8th and Marquette in Minneapolis, 6th and Roberts, St. Paul. Stop in soon at the Northwest's leading home financing institution, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature, and where you'll find plenty of free parking right at the door.
So Solomon built the house and finished it. And he built the walls of the house within with boards of cedar, both the floor of the house and the walls of the ceiling. And he covered them on the inside with wood, and covered the floor of the house with planks of fir.
And so it came to pass in the 1850s, settlers began thronging to the new land of Minnesota, and the church grew mightily. As the settlers came, so the men of God came in ever-increasing numbers. And in the years to follow, the priests and the ministers and the rabbis labored alongside the men of the congregation to build and to construct. At first, their houses of worship were built of logs. Then, as the sawmills began to hum along the St. Croix, neat white churches of newly sawed lumber began to appear. White pine slabs from Stillwater were used for flooring and pews in the Church of St. Paul. And the spires began to reach into the sky, tapering fingers pointed heavenward. And the congregations grew, reaching out across the land even as the spires reached upward. First immigrants in the great influx of the 1850s were mostly Irish and German Catholics. The Catholic population had so increased that St. Paul was made the seat of a diocese. The crude log church built by Father Gaultier was enlarged, and it became Minnesota's first cathedral. The Right Reverend Joseph Creighton of the Dubuque Diocese was appointed first bishop of Minnesota. The Catholic Church grew by leaps and bounds. Parochial schools were organized in St. Paul and St. Anthony in that same year. The first hospital in Minnesota, St. Joseph's, was opened in St. Paul. It was in the 1850s the foundations for St. John's Abbey were laid near St. Cloud. St. John's College and St. Benedictine Convent, were established there, and there was an equally amazing growth of the other faiths, Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Congregationalists, Baptists, and later the Lutherans, all springing up seemingly overnight, answering the call of the new settlers. One of the most welcome figures in far-flung settlements in those early days was the circuit rider. Perhaps the most famous of these Protestant riders was John Dyer, appointed to the Caledonia Circuit Mission south of Winona. Astride his horse, he rode from settlement to settlement and farm to farm.
Well, it's good to see you, Tom. How are you?
Howdy, Pastor. Mighty glad you could come around on this riding. We've been looking forward to this for a long time. Pastor, we got terrible trouble. Come in, won't you? Gets awful lonely here, especially now Johnny's gone.
All right. I'll come in, Tom. But kneel with me first. Lord God Almighty, we thank thee that thou hast brought these thy children through another month here in this land. And we pray thee, that thee watch over them, be with them in times of tribulation.
And in those days there came a new religious practice known as the revival meeting that has lasted for 100 years. Revivals reached a peak of popularity at the turn of the century with evangelist Billy Sunday. But back there in the 1860s, the revival meetings were just starting in Minnesota. The Methodists and the Baptists made most frequent use of them. At first, the meetings were held in crude buildings, sometimes in tents. Many times there was no floor, the ground was muddy, and sawdust was spread over the wet earth. And repentant sinners did, literally, come streaming down the sawdust trail. But that came after the evangelist had delivered his sermon. His text, from one of the prophets, warning the children of Israel of the dire consequences to befall them because they had turned from the Lord their God.
And my text for tonight, brothers and sisters, is found in the second chapter of Jeremiah, the 19th verse. Thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backsliding shall reprove thee. Know therefore and see that it is an evil thing and bitter that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God.
Then followed the sermon, the term that was used, hellfire and brimstone. Quoting chapter and verse, the evangelist threatened his listeners with precisely those things unless they abandoned drink and evil and turned from sin. The close of the service, the big climax of the service, was the invitation, and the evangelist pleaded and exhorted as the congregation sang softly.
And now, while our heads are bowed and our eyes are closed, there are some of you who are saying, Lord, I haven't led a good life. I've been a drunkard. I've been a sinner before God and before man. Lord, I want to lead a new life. Lord, I want to come down that sawdust trail. Lord, I want to beg forgiveness. Brothers, sisters, rise where you are. Come, lead a new life. There's a brother coming. Praise God, brother. And a sister. Oh, thank you, Lord. We're working miracles tonight.
And they came, sobbing as they walked, shuffling through the sawdust to the sinner's bench up front. Some backslid and were saved all over again when the revival meeting was held the next year or the next month. There were many who ridiculed the revival meeting. Some said it was too extreme, too emotional. But in the reckless frontier society, strong religious medicine was sometimes needed to produce results. The revival meeting was a vital force in the faith of our fathers. And through it, many were truly influenced to lead better lives.
The Star of David rose also in the young land of Minnesota. Jewish merchants and traders were among the early settlers. Some of them, like the Protestants and the Catholics, had been victims of religious persecution and economic hardship in their homelands. But here in America, in Minnesota, was the promise of freedom for all men, the freedom to worship as conscience demanded. The first Jewish congregation in Minnesota was established way back in 1856, Mount Zion Temple in St. Paul. And that congregation, by the way, is in existence today and is established in a new modern temple on Summit Avenue. The secretary of the Constitutional Convention and a signer of the Minnesota Constitution was Jacob Jackson Noah. He was elected the first clerk of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Persons of the Jewish faith were active in Minnesota from the early days. But the big wave of Jewish immigration came later, from the 1880s through the early 1900s. There was much rivalry among the various Christian religious bodies in the early days, but there was cooperation too. Methodist, Baptist, and Episcopal pastors realized the way to build for the future of the church was to teach the children. So on the 4th of July, 1856, Minnesota's first Sunday school parade was held in St. Paul. There were marching children, young boys on horseback, with parents and pastors joining in. The Minnesota Sunday School Association was formed in 1857 and was the forerunner of today's modern interdenominational and interfaith group, the Minnesota Council of Churches. A Wyndham attorney, A.D. Perkins, was an important figure in the Sunday School Association. He gave up the practice of law, stated he would rather work at preventing juvenile delinquency than sitting in judgment of it when it came into court.
Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungry and fed thee, and thirsty and gave thee drink? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me.
Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. The Indian Wars of 1862 brought a time of terror. The Sioux, crowded from their lands by the white invaders, rose in rebellion. They slaughtered men, women, and children, destroyed and burned settlements and farms. During that time of peril, ministers and priests of several faiths took a courageous stand. They dared to look with compassion not only on the settlers in their bereavement and sorrow, but also upon the plight of the Indians. It required courage, and among those men of God, one of the most outstanding was the Right Reverend Henry B. Whipple, first Episcopal Bishop of Minnesota. Another was the Reverend Stephen R. Riggs, and still another, Father Revaux of the Catholic Church. 300 Sioux were captured, were brought to Mankato, tried by a military court, and condemned to death. Riggs, who could speak the Sioux tongue, acted as interpreter. His intervention prevented the trials from becoming a complete mockery of justice. And Bishop Whipple dispatched a plea to President Lincoln. It was through the president's order that the lives of the remaining Indians were spared. And Father Revaux administered the sacrament of baptism to 24 of the 38 Sioux about to be hanged. The Protestant pastors gladly witnessed that work of grace, even though it was not in accordance with their own practice. 38 of the Sioux were hanged. Riggs later said with sadness,
We all did as nearly right then as we knew how. And we will not now defend the wrong, whatever it may be. But rather, I confess it and ask God's forgiveness.
In the fall of 1862, Bishop Whipple traveled to Washington to plead for better treatment of the Indians. And there he told President Lincoln about the outbreak, its causes, and the sufferings of the Sioux. Bishop Whipple talked with such force and such persuasion that President Lincoln remarked,
He came here the other day and talked with me about the rascality of this Indian business until I felt it down to my boots.
He who is greatest among you shall be your servant, and whomsoever exalts himself shall be humbled. And whomsoever humbles himself shall be exalted.
And among the men who worked for God in Minnesota was a forceful priest, Father John Ireland. No man worked harder than he. This was a time of building in Minnesota. The cathedral school had just been constructed in St. Paul. And now Father Ireland insisted there be a playground for the children.
But, Father Ireland, you have more important work to do in the care of this parish. We'll dig these stumps out. Why don't you go back to your duties?
Now, George, when you men were building the school for this cathedral, I lacked the skill to help you then. But here is something I can do. I can dig. You wouldn't deny me the pleasure of helping to build, would you?
In addition to Father Ireland's duties as a priest, he labored for civic betterment in a day when few even knew what the term meant. He was one of the founders of the total abstinence movement, combating the drunkenness that was all too prevalent. Catholics and Protestants alike applauded when he became bishop coadjutor of the St. Paul Diocese in 1875. Later, he became Archbishop Ireland, and his voice was heard in Washington and Rome. He did prodigious work as a representative of the Vatican in trying to prevent the Spanish-American War. Even though his efforts were to no avail, official Washington thanked him for his, quote, wonderful work for peace. On the 26th of April, 1918, word came to former President Theodore Roosevelt that his good friend in St. Paul was seriously ill. And the former president, who had been a lifelong Protestant, wrote,
My dear Archbishop Ireland, I don't know whether you'll be able to read this, but at least I hope that whoever does will tell you that I have written. You are one of the really great American figures. This country owes you very much. I feel not only deep concern and sympathy for you because of my friendship, but also as an American, because you have been one of the greatest influences for good in our American life. With very hearty and earnest hope for your complete recovery, ever yours, Theodore Roosevelt.
On the death of Archbishop Ireland the following September, there came another letter.
I mourn the death of Archbishop Ireland. He was a great patriot as well as a great churchman. He was an old and valued friend. And moreover, when with him, I felt I was in the company of a great ecclesiastical statesman of the old type in point of ability, and yet abreast of modern American thought. His death is a great loss. It leaves a very great blank in American life. Signed, Theodore Roosevelt.
And Archbishop Ireland will be remembered as one of the foremost leaders in the history of the Christian faith in Minnesota. The great granite cathedral that crowns a hilltop overlooking downtown St. Paul is both a monument to his memory and a symbol to his greatness.
Continue with our history of religion in Minnesota in just a moment. But first, a question. What do you believe as you watch history unfold? That there's nothing new under the sun? Or there are more things twixt heaven and earth than man has ever dreamed? Well, new things happen to people every day. But old things, tried and true guiding principles, somehow see us safely through. For instance, whatever the future holds, it's bound to be better, brighter, if we develop the good old-fashioned habit of thrift. Which brings me to one of my favorite subjects, Twin City Federal, where thrift certainly gets the encouragement of ample safety, generous dividends. Accounts are insured for safety by an agency of the United States government, and the current dividend rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly. People from all over the Northwest save at Twin City Federal, many by mail, and I'd be very happy to send you full details if you'll just address a card to me personally, Cedric Adams at WCCO. Or if you live close by and prefer to drive to Twin City Federal, remember, there's always ample free parking right at the door, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. You're listening to Faith of Our Fathers, the story of religion on Minnesota Milestones over your centennial station in Minneapolis and St. Paul, WCCO.
Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh, receiveth. And he that seeketh, findeth. and in the dark, it shall be over.
And men and women did seek, and church doors were opened. At the beginning of 1850, there were but a few churches in Minnesota. By 1870, the number of churches had increased to almost 900. And by the turn of the century, the number of churches in Minnesota had grown to more than 4,000. In the late 1800s and the early 1900s, thousands of Protestant immigrants from Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and Germany swelled the rolls of the Lutheran Church, making it the largest of the Protestant denominations. The Lutherans, unlike other groups, received little help from mother churches in Europe and so had to build their church in Minnesota literally from the ground up. This led to an almost baffling number of Lutheran synods based on nationality. The Augustana Synod was strong among the Swedes, and the Missouri and Minnesota synods were preferred by the Germans. The Norwegians formed many synods, and finally in 1917 merged three of them into the Evangelical Lutheran Church under the leadership of Dr. H. G. Stubb. And under Dr. J. A. Osgaard, the Evangelical Lutheran Church was changed from Norwegian into a truly American denomination. Today, the Norwegian language has almost completely disappeared from churches of the ELC.
And it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, that he began to build the house of the Lord.
And the Jewish community grew, even as the Christian. Mount Zion Temple was already established in St. Paul. Members were conducting their own services when, under the leadership of a St. Paul merchant, Julius Austrian, the congregation met and decided to raise money to hire a rabbi.
Friends and members of the Jewish community, because of the realization I have of how greatly a full-time rabbi is needed, not only for religious leadership, but also to teach our children, I would like to pledge $100 to help bring Rabbi Wittner to this congregation.
Julius put me down for $100.
Thank you, Max.
And my cousin in Louisville was a member of Rabbi Wittner's congregation. He's a fine man. I would like to put in $50.
Fine, Aaron, fine.
I pledge $20.
Good. All right, fine.
Rabbi Leopold Wittner of Louisville, the first rabbi to be permanently established in Minnesota, came to St. Paul. He was one of St. Paul's prominent civic and religious leaders in the late 1800s. It was under his guidance that Neighborhood House was established in 1897, and it remains one of St. Paul's great social institutions. The big wave of Jewish immigration came late in the 1880s and early 1900s, the result of the persecution in Russia. Rabbi Wexler urged Jews from European lands to come to Minnesota. Here they found freedom, if not complete acceptance. Some antagonisms developed among Orthodox, conservative, and Reformed Jews between Russians and Europeans. But these frictions were greatly reduced by Wexler's diplomatic leadership. Today, people of the Jewish faith, most of them in the Twin Cities, live peacefully among themselves and with their neighbors of every faith. It was in the late 80s that the first members of the Russian Orthodox faith came to Minnesota. The first church was built by Father Alexis Toth in Minneapolis back in 1889, and the first school in 1893. Most of the families in that first wave of migration came from four villages in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the portion that is now known as Czechoslovakia. The Greek Orthodox established their first church in Minneapolis about the time of World War I, and the other Orthodox churches of various nationalities followed. Nearly 70,000 families professing that faith now live in Minnesota, grouped in the Twin Cities and on the range.
Men of faith in Minnesota have felt the call to other duties, duties beyond the work of missions and the guiding of congregations. William Watts Falwell, one of Minnesota's greatest historians, calls Hastings Hornell Hart the apostle of public charities. The Reverend Mr. Hart was pastor of a congregational church in Worthington when he became interested in social conditions back in the 1880s. He made a series of investigations for the State Board of Corrections and Charities. As a result of these studies, Hart pointed out and condemned the long hours men and women were compelled to work in industry. He cried out against the low pay scale for farmhands and lack of training for attendants in mental hospitals. And in one report,
"Gentlemen, I have completed a survey of jails in the major cities of Minnesota. And, gentlemen, I find conditions deplorable. The filth of these buildings is indescribable. In only 7 of the 26 jails I've visited did I find conditions fit for human habitation."
And Hart spoke out against the manner in which young men in their teens were jailed or imprisoned with hardened criminals. He told how in prisons and mental institutions, male and female prisoners were sometimes housed in close proximity. Hart served for 15 years as Secretary of the State Board of Corrections and Charities. He finally secured establishment of the St. Cloud Reformatory. He pioneered in the use of parole and industrial training at the State Reform School. And historian Falwell describes a Minneapolis Universalist pastor, LeGrand Powers, as the apostle of labor. All too frequently, back there in the late 1800s, there were scenes such as this one.
You the new boy?
Well, it's my first day on this job.
Yeah, all right, well, listen, we got to cut this thing, see? Here, let me give you some advice. Now, sometimes it splinters. Now, if it looks like it's gonna, now you cover your face, see it fast.
All right, let's get started.
Now, look out there, son!
Oh, hey.
Jack! Jack, get the doctor! He's got him in the eye!
Industrial accidents, maiming, and crippling of workers were far more common in those days than now, and upon the recommendation of Reverend Powers as Commissioner of Labor, the Minnesota legislature in 1893 enacted a law for the protection of employees. That act required that all dangerous machinery in and around factories, all hoistways, hatchways, and elevator wells should be protected by proper guard equipment. It provided that all factories, mills, and workshops be kept clean, sanitary, and properly ventilated. It demanded that all buildings where persons are employed be equipped with fire escapes. And also, upon the insistence of the Reverend Mr. Powers, the legislature passed in 1895 acts regulating child labor and establishing sanitary conditions in bakeries. And clergymen, educators, established colleges and universities. Among them, Hamlin, McAllister, and St. Thomas in St. Paul, Augsburg in Minneapolis, St. John's in Collegeville, St. Mary's in Winona, and Concordia at Moorhead, Gustavus Adolphus in St. Peter, and Carleton and St. Olaf in Northfield. Ministers and priests, with the help of lay people, encouraged the growth of the medical profession and established hospitals to alleviate human suffering. Many of the hospitals you see in Minnesota today were established, were built by the men of God.
Remember the camp meetings? Many of you will, I know, I certainly do. The camp meetings reached their peak around the turn of the century. Perhaps the most famous of the camp meeting sites was Red Rock, located on the Mississippi River at Newport, about 7 miles south of St. Paul. Back in the days before the automobile, thousands and thousands of persons packed lunches, headed for the steamer landing in St. Paul and a glorious summer weekend at Red Rock. Steamboats and trains ran special excursions to Red Rock at reduced rates each summer. The St. Paul and St. Croix Steamboat Company, back in the summer of 1879, ran 3 of their boats from St. Paul to the camp meeting site every 40 minutes. And one Sunday in the summer of 1883, as many as 10,000 persons visited the camp meeting. There were tents, more than 200 of them pitched on the meeting grounds. There were dining halls and lodging halls, a preacher's home, a 3-story hotel. In this outdoor church, run for years by the Methodists, thousands gathered to hear the gospel. Though it was often argued that many came simply because Red Rock was a nice place for a picnic and because there was no place else to go, back in the days when transportation was limited. Red Rock continued to be the place for big weekends, even as late as the 1920s and 30s. But at last, people found other places more attractive as the motor car changed our weekend habits. In 1948, Red Rock was closed down for good and has now been swallowed up by streets and homes of a growing metropolitan area. Places of worship may change, but unchanged is the faith of our fathers. bring you the story of one of religion's most dramatic controversies in just a moment. But while we're following the growth of religion on Minnesota Milestones, I'd like to take just a moment here to tell you about the growth of our sponsor, Twin City Federal, which this year, by the way, celebrates its 35th anniversary. Over the years, Twin City Federal has grown soundly, steadily, to become a nationally outstanding savings institution and the Northwest's leading home financing institution. 95,000 persons from our area have obtained home loans at Twin City Federal, and more than 100,000 people save there. Resources at Twin City Federal now total more than $285 million. Well, I'd say that adds up to the fact that folks obviously like the safety, the security, the service of doing business at Twin City Federal. Wouldn't you agree? Now then, if you're in the market for a home loan or a savings account, I'm sure you will too. Why not stop in and get acquainted at Twin City Federal, the $250 million association, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature.
Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the air, and over the cattle, and over all earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth.
And it is written that God created man in his own image. And a great debate raged in Minnesota through the 1920s. A man who rose to prominence in those days was the Reverend William B. Riley, pastor of the First Baptist Church in Minneapolis. The debate concerned the teaching of Darwin's theory of evolution, particularly at the University of Minnesota and at Carleton College. Starting in the early 20s, Dr. Riley directed a verbal attack at the University of Minnesota, challenging its authority to teach evolution, which he held to be a godless doctrine directly contrary to the teachings of the Bible. The situation came to a head in 1925 when the famous Scopes trial at Dayton, Tennessee, aroused the nation's interest. Pastors of the Anti-Evolution League in Minnesota, led by Dr. Riley, declared their first decision, quote, to no longer endure this condition. Dr. Riley addressed the students at convocations held in the Armory Building on the Minneapolis campus, meetings that were attended by thousands of students.
Professors and teachers in this state-supported university would rob us of the heritage that has come down to us in this blessed book, the Bible. They would replace the words of the scriptures, "In the beginning, God created heaven and earth," with a godless and atheistic doctrine that we are descended from the apes. I challenge the right of the University of Minnesota, supported by the taxpayers of this state, to teach this.
Dr. Riley's series of attacks included not only the university and the atheists. He also assailed the so-called modernists, or people of liberal religious thought. They in turn held that Dr. Riley was attacking one of the basic propositions of the Constitution of the United States, the Bill of Rights itself, that he was attacking the right of each man to determine for himself how he should worship. And in the case of the atheists, the right not to worship at all if they so chose. The war of ideas reached its critical climax in March 1926 when Dr. Riley announced he would go again to the university and deliver a lecture entitled, "Should the Teaching of Evolution Be Tolerated in This State University?" University authorities announced in return,
"We consider the tone of Dr. Riley's topic to be unsuitable to an open forum. We are therefore withdrawing our invitation to Dr. Riley to address the students."
Dr. Riley rented the Kenwood Armory in Minneapolis, and to a crowd of thousands, he spoke on his announced subject and against the university.
"It grieves me deeply, ladies and gentlemen, that though I have visited university after university, speaking to students by the tens of thousands in every part of the land, that I am excluded from our own state university, the University of Minnesota. I charge that an evolution combine exists at the University of Minnesota. I intend to get an injunction to bar from the university all textbooks teaching evolution. And I ask the help of you, the taxpayers of this great state of Minnesota, to help carry this fight against godless teaching to the state legislature."
In March of 1927, Dr. Riley presented his bill to the Minnesota legislature. It would have outlawed the teaching in any tax-supported educational institution in Minnesota that man either descended or ascended from a lower order of animals. The campus of the university seethed with protest meetings. 4,563 university students signed petitions against Dr. Riley's proposal, which became known at the time as the Anti-Monkey Bill. The president of the university, Dr. Lotus D. Kaufman, spoke in defense of academic freedom. The scene was a joint public hearing of the Minnesota Senate and House Committees on Education in the House Chamber. That was the evening of March 9th, 1927, and the crowd jammed the galleries.
The meeting of this joint committee will now come to order. May we please have order in the house? We will hear now from the distinguished president of the University of Minnesota, Dr. Lotus D. Kaufman.
Members of the joint committee, ladies and gentlemen, I am opposed to this bill for the reason that it is contrary to the genius of American life. The spirit of America will wither and decay when correctness of scientific theories is decided by legislation or by the counting of heads. If that method had been followed in the past, as is proposed today, we should be meeting tonight clothed in the skins of beasts we had killed by bows and arrows. Squatted around a campfire in a cave, we should be trying to decide whether to burn or behead some member of our tribe who said that the god of harvest was greater than the god of the hunt. I am opposed to this bill for the reason that it will depreciate the good name and bring ridicule upon the University of Minnesota. In the 2,000 years since the beginning of Christianity, groups of men have risen from time to time to proclaim that Christian civilization was threatened and Christian faith undermined by teaching that the world was round or that it revolved around the sun or that there was danger in the wonders discovered by the telescope and the microscope. I am opposed to this bill for the reason that I can think of no reasonable justification for it. It will stifle learning, cripple research, destroy intellectual integrity, doom the university to mediocrity or less, and it will not make students more religious. To pass this bill would be tantamount to serving notice on the scholars of America if they value their reputation and their peace and happiness to keep away from Minnesota. Let the doubtful honor of striking a blow at free schools and the principles upon which our government rests pass to such communities and states as do not know how to cherish and defend them.
The Senate defeated the anti-evolution bill 55-7, and the House allowed it to die in committee. Controversial though Dr. Riley was, he remains one of the men of strength in the faith of our fathers. He established Northwestern Bible School and Northwestern Evangelical Seminary, which is known today as Northwestern College.
And in recent years, Minnesota has become internationally prominent as a center of Christianity. Episcopalians from every corner of the world gathered in Minneapolis for the Anglican Congress. In the summer of 1957, Minneapolis was host to the Lutheran World Federation, a meeting of delegates representing 50 million Lutherans from every continent on the globe. And in a world which now lies uneasy under the threat of nuclear annihilation, the faith grows stronger. In Minnesota today, Catholics have established a new spiritual jurisdiction, the Diocese of New Ulm. New churches of all faiths are springing up, particularly in suburban areas. Lutherans, Baptists, Presbyterians, Unitarians, Methodists, Congregationalists, Jew and Gentile, each worshiping God in his own way.
And according to a survey published by the National Council of Churches of Christ in the United States in 1956, there were more than 61 separate religious denominations in Minnesota, with a total enrollment of more than 1,798,000 persons, attending more than 4,000 churches. In addition to those groups mentioned earlier, the larger denominations include the Assemblies of God, the Disciples of Christ, Evangelical and Reformed, Evangelical United Brethren, Christian Reformed Church, the Moravian Church in America, Reformed Church in America, Church of the Nazarene, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Christian Scientists, the Mormons, and those of the Eastern Orthodox faiths. More than 25% of the children in Minnesota receive their elementary school education from parochial schools. Using radio and television, religion is reaching even those who claim no church affiliation.
And the future of religion in Minnesota? Our state will be looking to men of God and men of goodwill for continued leadership and cooperation. The understanding that brought Minnesota from a frontier wilderness to a peaceful land where church spires stand tall against the sky. Minnesota, a land of religious freedom. A land where men of all faiths and beliefs strive to live together and work together in harmony, always building on the faith of our fathers.